House Committee on Judiciary to order February 28th, 2011, Monday. Staff, what's our first bill?
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. Our first bill for public hearing is House Bill 3034. This bill pertains to ORS 10.055, which regulates the service of jury duty. Currently, a judge or clerk of the court is allowed to let a person who's been summoned as a juror to defer their jury service on a finding of good cause. House Bill 3034 would specify that only one deferral of jury duty is allowed under this section, except in very exceptional circumstances that couldn't have been anticipated at the time of the first service: death in a person's family, serious illness, national disaster, etc. A person requesting a subsequent deferral must provide a list of no fewer than 10 dates within the six-month period immediately following the date of the second request on which they would definitely be available to perform their service.
Okay, is it Deborah Haroon? Heron? Simple Heron?
Simple, like the bird, but with two R's.
Looks like you got somebody else there with you, huh? Sir?
Thank you, Mr. Chair Krieger and Chair Parker and committee members. My name is Andy Olson. And can you hear me okay? All right. Anyways, my name is Andy Olson. I'm a state representative out of the Albany area. House Bill 3034, I've just kind of titled jury service. You heard this 2 years ago with a little bit of a modification to the bill, which I'll explain a little bit more as we get into this. Have an amendment in the process right now to get it corrected to what the final version was that Representative Garrett suggested 2 years ago in this committee. This bill is a real common sense approach to jury service. It gives some discretion to the courts, but it also sets some parameters as well. And additionally, if you follow along with my letter that I've sent to you, this bill makes it very clear a citizen who dutifully exercises their obligation as a citizen can't be penalized by their employer for call to service. Essentially, they can't be forced to take vacation leave, sick leave, or other type of leave for absence. The amendment that we have right now deals with Section 2, and it's just going to address the issue of good cause for being able to miss jury service. So with that, also give you a heads up to Chair Krieger, Chair Barker, that this bill did pass the House floor last session, and then it was kind of toward the end of the session, and it just died.
Hey, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. There's lots of great ideas that die in the Senate. But anyway, Representative, I have zero unexcused absences as a legislator. I have been let off the hook on jury duty while we're in session. Could you put in your, I'm dead serious here too, could we add in the amendment an exemption of legislators while we're in session so that we don't, I mean, you could be gone for a week. If you got called right at the end of the session, you could be one vote that makes a difference and it could drag out the whole session. So could we put that in there?
Representative Shoffler, I don't think that's necessary because given the circumstances, if you have the communication with a judge regarding the situation, because I'll tell you, since this is my fourth term, I've been called into U.S. District Court. I've been called into a couple other courts as well for trials, and I've been able to find the time, but they were willing also to adjust for me.
All right, thank you.
Anyone else?
Just to clarify that, and so if I get excused once and then the next time they call me, it would be in the middle of session, but there's still a clause where I can tell the judge I'm in session, he'd say, okay, give me 4 dates in the future when you will be here. Is that not correct?
10 dates.
That's right. And actually, let me read to you what Section 2 will be with the amendment, okay? And it'll be a little bit more clearer for you to follow. A judge or clerk may allow more than one deferral of jury duty under this section only for good cause. And that's the key portion there. A person requesting a deferral under this subsection must provide a list of not less than 10 dates within the six-month period following the date of the request on which the person would be able to commence jury duty. And that happened to be the issue that we were interested in 2 years ago, was the just or the good cause portion.
Thank you.
Chair Krieger, Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Deborah Heron, and I'm here to testify on behalf of the Oregon Liability Reform Coalition. We've worked with Representative Olson on developing this bill and do so because we feel that defendants have a right to a jury of their peers, and we would hope that this bill would enable two things. One, to strengthen the jury pool, and also ensure that citizens who do respond to that call to jury have some flexibility in their schedules so that they can respond to the clerk and make it appropriate for the time on their calendar by being able to list the 10 dates that they would be available the 6 months in the future for responding to jury service. We feel that this is a good common sense bill that allows room for clerks to be reasonable and at the same time makes a very clear public statement about the importance of jury service and that this is something that is our obligation and is expected of us as citizens in Oregon. Thank you.
Committee, anything further? Appears not. Thank you. We'll close the public hearing then on 3034 and open a public hearing on 3040.
Thank you. Co-chairs, members of the committee, proposed House Bill 3040 expands the authority of the court and the Violations Bureau to reduce fines for violations. Right now, in terms of violations such as traffic tickets, current ORS 153053 tells the courts not to defer, waive, suspend, or otherwise reduce the fines for violation except under very narrow circumstances, and caps most reductions down to 75% of their base value. House Bill 3040 would permit the courts to drop that all the way down to 50% of the base fine. The court would be further authorized to make additional reductions under several enumerated circumstances, including fines for vehicle based on an equipment being missing or broken where the equipment is subsequently repaired, or for circumstances in which the defendant has not been convicted of an offense or violation within the three-year period immediately preceding the date on which the citation is issued, or for any other basis that is inconsistent with justice. It's important to note that nothing in this section allows a court to reduce any fine below the minimum fine amount established by statute.
All right, Eddie Bowles.
Thank you, Chair Krieger and Chair Barker and committee members. My name is Andy Olson, and I'm state representative out of the Albany area. House Bill 3040, again, some of you have heard of this bill once again. Representative Wisnett, you might remember this one from 07 as well as 09. But in 2007, this committee passed it out of the committee, and it actually kind of got held up in Ways and Means is what happened. But having served 29 years with the Oregon State Police and now serving in my third term here in Judiciary, this bill, what it does essentially is return back to the minimum mandatory fine level of what before the legislature acted to increase it in the year 2003. And if you just follow along here with me, it does not impact ORS 153018, which provides maximum sentencing guidelines for the class A, B, C, and D violations. What it does do is very simple. And the 4 points is it gives discretion to the court to reduce the fine no less than 50% of the base fine. It gives discretion to the court to lower the fine for vehicle equipment related violations in which the driver has corrected the equipment violation. Additionally, the court may lower the fine if the driver has not been convicted of an offense within a three-year period of receiving another citation. And the court may impose a fine lower than the amount required if the court determines the defendant to be indigent or if the fine required in subsection 1 would be inconsistent with justice. The mandatory minimum fine was increased by 75% or to 75% in the 2003 legislature. This bill just returns to the 50% level, as I've already mentioned. Now, this was brought to my attention by a number of judges several years ago. What the problem was that you have somebody that might be traveling, first time they've ever received a traffic citation, and they've been driving for 30 to 40 years on the road, and they come up to a stop sign, and the stop, they don't do a very good job of stopping. But they come as close as you can get. California stop, I reckon. The point being with this is that the individual gets stopped, issued a citation, and that individual comes in, first citation they've ever received, pleads guilty in front of the judge regarding it. The judge doesn't have a choice in the matter. And I mean, it might be a very healthy citation. Given the structure of the minimum mandatory, they have to stay within the framework of that. So that's some of the discussion that we had regarding that. Now, some of you might think, well, wow, there could be a reverse effect on this if we should return back to the 50% discretion for the courts, mainly because of the revenue issue. And that was one of the things that caused the bill to die a few years ago in Ways and Means. Now, you have in front of you a chart that I have given you, and this is something that Representative Krieger and Chair Barker have both shared with you before, and we've had this discussion. But if you take a look at this chart, and you can kind of see what is going on there with the criminal fine assessment account, the CFAA, which you heard a little bit about last week when, at that time, Chief Mark Adams from Kaiser Police Department was here. And if you recall, I asked him the question if he noticed the volume of citations decreased. And if you remember, he said he had. Well, this line is pretty indicative of what's happening, because at one time when the courts had discretion from 95 on up, where you see the huge increase, courts had discretion. The legislature stepped in 99 and changed that to that structure, and I think both these judges here that are with me right now will discuss a little bit more in detail about that. But then you can see where it had impact on what happened with the revenue as well as the volume. There's just something inherent with police officers being on the road, and I can say that from experience, that the higher the citation is, the more inclined or unlikely that you'll receive a citation, because police officers take that in consideration. And, you know, when you start thinking about where we're at today in our society, and especially the economic situation, that $200 citation could really take a lot of food out of someone's mouth. I mean, that's how I look at things. But then in 2009, the last session, toward the tail end, you can see where the surcharge that we added onto this kicked in, and how everything just went downhill then the last year and a half. That's what I want to point out to you at this point. I really do believe, because of the major increase in what we were trying to do with the traffic violations here, if you reversed that, you would actually see an increase. And I do believe that from having been a police officer. So I have with me Judge Carl Myers and also Judge Jad Blumhouse.
Co-Chair Krieger, Co-Chair Barker, Carl Myers on behalf of the Oregon Municipal Judges Association and the Oregon Justice of the Peace Association. As you may recall, last week I was here to oppose a bill that would cut back on the discretion of judges in traffic matters. Obviously, today I'm in support of this bill because it does give judges more discretion to be able to deal with traffic fines on an individual case-by-case basis without the severe restrictions that are placed on us by the 75%. The inability to reduce a fine less than 75% of the base fine. Judge Blumhouse will talk you through this and has far more experience than I in dealing with these kinds of matters, but I'll be here to answer any questions that you may have. Thank you for your time.
Mr. Co-Chairman, members of the committee, I'm
Jad Lebhouse, Lynn County Justice of the Peace. I've brought for you this afternoon three charts that I think will be instructive about how the system works. And the object of the discussion that I'm going to present is to tie the fairness issue in with the revenue issue. Carl, let's start with the CFAA payments. There you go. Thank you. Before we get to the charts, however, I want to make sure that you have a fundamental understanding of how revenue from courts works. There are two kinds of actions that are filed in courts, civil actions and criminal actions. There's a significant distinction between how the revenue stream flows from civil actions as opposed to the revenue stream from criminal actions. In a civil action, you don't see the judge until after you've paid all the fees. You've paid a filing fee, you've paid a hearing fee, you've paid a recording fee, you've paid motion fees. You paid a number of fees, and you don't see the judge until you pay the fees. Everything is before you see the judge. In a criminal action, it's just the opposite. You don't pay anything until you've seen the judge, and the judge has told you what the fine's going to be. A fundamental distinction. So a judgment in a traffic offense violation, in effect, becomes a
retail consumer
transaction. Where they're either going to pay it in full, they're going to pay it in installments, or they're not going to pay it at all. Now, the
thing we're talking about
here today is discretion. And so if you look on your charts or the big chart in the table, you'll notice that there was a period of time when everything went up, 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 and up. And then it peaked in 2001. The 1995 legislature reduced fines across the board, gave judges complete discretion over the amount of fines and assessments to impose on violation offense. I mean complete discretions. It was from zero to the maximum fine plus assessments. Complete discretion. The 99 legislature changed that a little bit in that it established some minimum fines, but it allowed judges the discretion to reduce the fine in circumstances where a person was indigent, or it would be unjust to impose the minimum fine. Revenue continued to climb until the year 2001. You may remember that in the 2001-2003 biennium, we had a recession very similar to what we're undergoing now. Those of you who were in the legislature in the spring of 2003 might remember that one of the first things you had to do was readjust the budget in order to be able to match the revenue with expenditures. And so what you see, because of the change in the financial position of most of the people that were paying fines, as they dip in the revenue that came through the courts. The 2003 legislature increased the fines, increased the computation of the base fines, increased the mandatory minimum fines, and eliminated totally discretion of judges to deal with indigence or unjust circumstances. The 2009 legislature then added an offense surcharge. After the 2003 session, things just kind of level off. They went up a little bit, but then after about year 2008, everything started going south. And the $45 offense surcharge that is now added on to violation offenses made it even worse. Right now, in this fiscal year, payments from the circuit courts are 14% less than they were last year. Payments from local courts to the criminal fine and assessment account are 10% less than they were last year. So overall, it's about a 13% reduction from the same six-month period from June to December as in this current fiscal year as it was in last fiscal year. The upshot is, instead of the $9.5 million that was projected from that offense surcharge gain to the criminal fine assessment account, there's going to be about a $9.5 million loss to the criminal fine assessment account. Now, Judge Barnes, if you put up the convictions chart. Unfortunately, I don't have data past the year 2001 on convictions. But what the conviction chart does is it shows you what happens when fines get increased. You notice that the peak was in the year 2003. That's when we had the most convictions. Now, one of the charts that I did not bring that I have would show you that we have actually on duty now more peace officers than we had in 2003. We don't have the numbers yet for the convictions for 2010, but my guess is they're going to continue that trend and go down. reason convictions are going down is because officers aren't writing as many tickets. They're giving more warnings. You have a mom with some kids in a car, and she's gone 69 miles an hour in a 55-mile zone. You walk up to the window, and she rolls down the window, and you hear the kids crying, and the mom's frantic trying to get home. And you're going to give her a $190 ticket? Some officers are going to say, no, I'll just give that lady a warning. And so we don't have nearly as many citations being filed in courts. And when the lady gets to court, if she did get a ticket, what's the judge going to say? I pay $190? The judge is going to look for some other way to deal with that circumstance and try to make it more fair for that person. And so convictions are going down. If you put up the next chart. The next chart is suspensions for failure to pay fines. Now, the Department of Motor Vehicles imposes a number of driving suspensions for a number of different reasons. The only thing that's shown on this chart is the driver suspensions that were entered on the given year for failing to pay the fine, failure to comply with an order to pay fines. You see the trend line there? Judge Myers, if you'll hold up the convictions chart right alongside the suspensions chart.
Look at the trend line there.
I didn't have the trend line put in, but if you took a dark line and put the trend line in, you'd see that they're heading towards each other. If you look at the suspensions in 2003 and compare that with the number of the convictions, there were almost 600,000 convictions, but only about 113 or 114 suspensions, one out of every six. Look at it in 2009. About 450,000 convictions and about 118 suspensions. 118,000 suspensions. One out of every four drivers who was convicted in a court in the year
2009.
This is the fairness side of it. Judges can't do things that are fair. We can't do things that are fair. Revenue goes down. That's the first chart. This one right here. That's why we had this huge decrease in revenue from 2008 to what we're going to see in 2011. You've got to do two things. Number one, restore discretion. Give judges an opportunity to make things work for people. Number two, we have this offense surcharge. It's due to sunset in June of 30th of this year. Let it sunset so we can bring the total number that the officer has to write on the ticket down. Let that surcharge expire. Enact House Bill 3040 to give judges discretion to deal fairly with people. Now, we're not going to see a huge turnaround and a big escalation in revenue. The economic circumstances presently are not going to allow that to happen. But we're going to stop the bleeding. We're going to turn it around and get it going up. When I'm sitting on the bench, I don't give a rip about revenue. The only thing I'm concerned about is that person who's before me. And I want to make sure the judgment that I enter is fair. The one thing I want to do is do something that's fair for that person in their circumstances. I don't give a rip about revenue. It doesn't matter. It shouldn't matter to you either. What should matter is treating the public fair. Right now we're suspending so many people who are convicted because they can't pay the fine. Well, guess what, folks? You know this as well as I. What's our unemployment rate? About 12%? What's our underemployment rate? Another 12, 15, 20%? Those are the folks who can't pay their tickets. What can judges do? Nothing. Unless you allow us to do it. The 95 and the 99 legislature allowed us to do it. They said, okay, judges, here's the base fine. This is the amount that we think that is appropriate in a particular case. And if you find that it's inadequate because of the driver's record or some other circumstances, you can go above that amount and impose up to the max. Here's the minimum fine. We think this is the fine that is appropriate for circumstances where a person shouldn't have to pay the base fine. But if, in this particular case, and only this case, you find, as a judge, that there is a circumstance of indigence, or unjustness that makes it difficult or impossible for this person to pay the minimum fine, you can go below that. We need to go back there.
If we go back, we're going to see a turnaround in this revenue roll.
And remember, we're talking about basically what's a retail consumer transaction here. You're either going to pay the... It's like buying a big screen TV. Prices of big screen TVs have come down. You know why? So many people buy the thing because the price is lower. Well, we keep raising the price, and guess what? We raise the price, and we get fewer convictions. We make it impossible for judges to treat people fair, and guess what? We get fewer convictions. And when we get fewer convictions, we get less money, and we get more people suspended because they can't pay their fines.
Representative Olson, is the 50% deviation enough?
Yeah, that's a great question, Chair Krieger and Chair Barker. I'm listening to Judge Limhouse right now. I'm thinking, wow, I wonder what it would look like if we went back to 1995. I think right now I would move forward with, and I would be quite pleased if we, if our body would move back and return to the level of it was prior to 03, which would be the 50%. I understand what you're saying.
It was my opinion that in the years that we worked, it was to change the behavior of their driving habits for the purpose of public safety, and the fines weren't put in place for the purpose of raising revenue to be bled off for every place you can find it. And you see what's in some of our laws today. We talked about this, that this could be the result of stacking this stuff up back in 2003 and on up. I think now we see the fruit of that. So I have a great concern of where we are, exactly where we're going to go here. We'll see in a few minutes. Representative, did you have a comment?
I have a question, and I'm not sure any of the witnesses at this table would have the answer to it, but I'll ask it, and if they don't, maybe I'll ask staff to try to find it elsewhere. Do we have information tracking traffic stops that result in warnings instead of citations?
Co-chairs and Representative Nolan, no, there is no central database. Many of the law enforcement agencies keep some of those records, and so you could probably pull the sheriff's offices and the city peace officers and the Oregon State Police to ascertain how many written warnings. But that doesn't tell you the full picture, because not every warning is a written warning. Sometimes an officer will make a stop, make a visit, so to speak, with the person, and then say, have a nice day, and go on. There's no written warning. There's no citation. There's just a
discussion about what's the more appropriate conduct
all along when driving a motor vehicle on Oregon's highways.
Therein is the dilemma for me, Mr. Co-Chair and colleagues. I do think it would be worth trying to get the information if it's readily available, because part of the assertion is that officers are making stops and hesitating because of the size of the fine, yet we're absent any data that backs that up other than anecdotal, and I'm not doubting the anecdotes, but if we're making law, we ought to base it on actual evidence. It might actually be that perhaps the fine is doing its job of serving as some deterrent, and until we have a thorough analysis of that, it's hard to know what the antecedent of the behavior is.
What we're advocating here has nothing to do with the fine, in a sense. We don't think you should change that, other than to allow the surcharge to expire. What I think, and what Judge Myers thinks, and what Representative Olson has proposed, is simply to give judges more leeway in dealing with people when they come into court. We basically, public safety is what we're interested in, highway safety in particular, when traffic offenses are concerned.
But it's not necessarily appropriate for everybody to pay the same amount. We all have different economic status. We all have different obligations. Many of the people that come into court are in this either unemployed or underemployed sector, which is a fairly large segment of the population presently. And it's really not fair for them to have to pay a $300
fine. Well, $287 ticket when they go 79 miles an hour on the freeway.
And Mr. Co-Chair, it looks like Representative Olson wants to weigh in on this, but I'd then like a follow-up, if I might.
Okay, Olson.
Chair Krieger, Chair Barker, and Representative Nolan. I can't speak for on behalf of the other agencies around the state, but I do know that state police do, through their CAD system or computer-aided dispatch system, that they do collect the data regarding warnings.
Good. We can follow up. So if I might follow up. The assertion then is that setting a fine and allowing discretion at the judge's level is sufficient to change the behavior
on the streets.
An officer, because I'm hearing testimony that officers are hesitating to issue citations because there's a minimum fine. But I thought I just heard you say that if the officer knew that the judge had the discretion to adjust that fine, that would take away the barrier to the officers writing the citations.
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Noling, I think that's essentially correct. I think the reticence or reluctance to write citations would be somewhat ameliorated by the fact that the officers know that courts have discretion. One of the reasons why you see that big drop in convictions in the year 2003 was when the 2003 changes went into effect. And if you take a look at the fourth page, I describe what those changes are, and you'll see that they're fairly significant, where the mandatory minimum fine approached, or in some cases even exceeded, the base fine that was in effect before that statute took effect. And so jumping officers at that point in time were extremely reluctant to write citations.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Judge, great testimony, pretty clear. I guess a question to Representative Olson. Thank you for bringing the bill, Representative. What happened last session, and I don't understand why Ways and Means, it should be revenue, I guess, and it doesn't look like we have a referral on this one, so do we think we can move this through the system this time? And did we have the same data that we presented last time? I don't remember.
Chair Krieger, Representative Wisdom, I can't answer that, why it doesn't have referral to Ways and Means. If we're going to count numbers, there could very easily be, from a legislative fiscal office perspective, that there will be lost revenue. I think it's going to go the other direction.
All right,
Thank you.
Representative Barker.
Thank you. Judge, both of you, and I know you can't speak for all the other judges by any means, but a lot of these people you're talking about also can't miss a day of work to come see you. So they send in a letter, and I would ask that through your judicial groups, your judges' groups, would you help get people to try, judges, to try to really pay attention to letters people send in so you don't miss a day. And I know it's a lot different in a smaller court. I have worked in different areas. In Columbia County, traffic court was certainly different than Multnomah County traffic court, which was, you know, more like a factory with things moving down. Just Lucy trying to eat the chocolates off the thing. I mean, it really roars through there. But I would hope that that judges would take into consideration a letter sent in from people who really can't take a day off work, or they're be even farther behind. And I've heard a lot of people say, "I'll just send in the money. I can't afford to take a day off, miss a day of work."
Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, Carl Myers, again on behalf of the municipal judges and the JP judges. We've talked about this in all of our conventions, our seminars. I do not believe there is a local court that does not review the letters and take into consideration all the circumstances in rendering a decision. There has been, during the interim committee, there was testimony about some courts that did not review letters. I believe those are circuit courts. To my knowledge, none of the JP courts or the municipal courts shortchange a defendant in reviewing their file and the circumstances and rendering a decision.
Okay, thank you.
And I will add, we're going to be meeting later this week, and we're going to talk some more about that. And it is my job as sort of the interface between you and the judges to make sure that they understand legislative public policy in that regard.
Okay, thank you. And I hope somebody can tell the circuit courts as well. I know they're awfully busy. The only other thing I'd add is that in Portland, at least 10 years ago, when you made a traffic stop, you had to check out of a computer before you could leave, and one of the questions was the result. So you'd say warning or citation or arrest or not, anyway, or search. And so all those things should be captured, some of that. And if the state police in Portland have that information, that might be a good indicator. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Chair Krieger, members of the committee, and actually this is following up on a point made by Chair Krieger. Your Honor, I just want to see if I understand the proposal correctly. My understanding looking at subsection 1 is that a court can come down to 50% on any of these violations, but then in subsection 2, the Court of Violations Bureau may impose a fine lower than that if, and then there are all of these various bases, including indigency and other repairs. So am I reading that correctly, that 50% is the floor on what a court can impose, or if the court makes a finding of indigency or one of the other bases, that they can actually go below 50% all the way down to the statutorily minimum defined fine?
Yes, that's my understanding. The 50% is the new minimum, and then if there are particular circumstances of indigence or unjust circumstances, then the court can actually depart below the mandatory minimum.
Okay, so thank you, Your Honor, for that. That's clear, but a little follow-up. So you can get from the presumptive fine down to 50% just sort of without a finding of indigency or one of the other bases. That's just sort of you showed up, you played along, you've got a good attitude, so I'll use my discretion to get you down to 50%.
Correct, from the baseline. We don't have a presumptive fine in Oregon.
Right. From the I understand you can go up or down, sure, but from the baseline fine.
Right.
Okay. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you.
Thank you. Close the public hearing on 3040 and open a public hearing on 3085.
And thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. Presently, ORS 676260 requires a healthcare provider to notify law enforcement if the provider becomes aware of the result of a blood test that a patient who was involved in a motor vehicle crash has alcohol on board. This hasn't been construed to date as actually requiring a healthcare provider to perform a blood test, but just if they're doing one anyhow and they become aware of the existence of alcohol, they are obligated to notify law enforcement. Proposed House Bill 3085 would expand that to cover sort of all toxicology screens that are done in connection with the crash, their testings of blood. So if a hospital or emergency care provider finds out that there's a controlled substance on board, heroin, methamphetamine, cocaine, whatever, they have a similar obligation to notify law enforcement.
We have Chuck Sparks, Ann Pratt, and Darlene Hull.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and Chair Krieger, members of the committee. My name is Chuck Sparks. I'm here on behalf of the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. I supervise the trial unit that handles vehicular assaults and homicides in Multnomah County, and I'm here to testify on behalf of House Bill 3085. As is currently the law, and as was just summarized by legislative counsel, the law currently requires that healthcare providers report 0.08 or higher BACs when someone is reasonably believed to be the driver post-crash in the medical facility receiving treatment for that crash. It does not require that any additional testing be done. It's simply testing that's already being done. If it reveals an 08 or higher, it would be reported. What this bill would do is simply complete the picture and give parity to the drug driver and assist law enforcement in holding the drugged drivers responsible, people who either are using controlled substances and alcohol or purely controlled substances. And it would most directly affect the situation that are purely controlled substance cases. I think it's important to note that as it stands now, there are, we think, a substantial number of these cases that are not prosecutable because we just don't learn about a person's controlled substances. We don't learn that post-crash they have these substances on board. Whereas with alcohol, we do. And this would simply create a situation of parity where people who are using controlled substances are held responsible, as are people who are using alcohol at this time. A few points I wanted to make is the proposal would not require any testing. I think Legislative Council already mentioned that it does not require that the healthcare facility test the individual. It simply requires the reporting of testing that's already being done. And so the healthcare provider, the facility, would report that to law enforcement. Typically, we're there investigating the crash anyway. And when I say we, usually a deputy district attorney accompanies, at least in Multnomah County, the crash team to the hospital if we have somebody who's been seriously hurt or killed by a driver who may be under the influence of anything, controlled substance or alcohol. It does not affect any medical care that's given. Does not intrude in any way. It doesn't require tests that would not otherwise be done. It's also important, I think, to note that the hospital's findings, which would be reported, are typically would not be used as the sole basis for going forward and charging somebody. What would happen is we would take this information, we would then put it into an application for a search warrant, ask a judge to authorize that a sample of blood be taken, and we could then go forward and test that, whether it be at the Oregon State Police Crime Lab or an independent forensic lab. And then, as I note in point six in my summary, we would retain those blood samples, and they would be available for independent retesting by the defense. So obviously there's that additional assurance, both to the medical care facility that we're not taking their results and using it in almost any circumstance as the sole basis for prosecution. It's simply what starts the investigation. It alerts us to the problem so that we can then properly investigate, obtain a search warrant if a judge is willing to give us a search warrant, and move forward. I think I've touched on the fact that we think that there are cases we're missing now. We know that in part because we have the reporting of the 08 or higher, and we often find out that people have other substances on board in addition to alcohol. And we know there are circumstances where people are coming into the hospital where we think there's a good chance that is so, that they're using a controlled substance, but we don't find out, or we simply are never alerted. There's a crash, and there is no investigation that follows because we don't have access to the individual to check out and investigate. We simply don't get the information. I believe that summarizes my testimony. Thank you.
Okay, Ann, do you want to go ahead?
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Krieger and Co-Chair Barker and members of the committee. My name is Ann Pratt. I'm a member of Crime Victims United, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII. Thank you to Chuck Sparks, first of all, for bringing this bill forward. In 2007, we saw the need to seek greater cooperation between law enforcement and hospitals or trauma centers that may be treating intoxicated drivers. Officer Darkhall, Murray Armstrong, and Crime Victims United requested House Bill 2895, which helped clarify the statute on who and when a healthcare facility must notify law enforcement. And we tightened up the time frame which they had to report in. Today we are here to ask that controlled substances, also be added to that requirement. Drug driving has been on the rise for years, and it makes perfect sense to add controlled substances to the statute. According to FARS, which is Fatality Analysis Reporting System, 1 in 3 drivers with known drug testing who were killed in motor vehicle accidents crashes in 2009 tested positive for drugs, illegal drugs, and as well as medications. The FARS report, which was conducted by the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration, makes it clear our national drug driving problem is severe and getting worse. New data adds to the growing body of research shows too far many Americans are getting behind the wheel with drugs in their system. A recent roadside survey revealed that 1 in 8 nighttime weekend drivers tested positive for an illicit drug, and that about 1 in 6 tested positive for illicit or licit drugs, including medications. House Bill 3085 also encourages cooperation and enables greater efficiency and law enforcement to collect the necessary evidence and remove the intoxicated drivers from our roadways. It also guards the safety of all Oregonians. And testing and reporting drugs and alcohol in crashes also can help offenders get the necessary treatment for any underlying problems with drugs and alcohol. Please pass or forward on House Bill 3085. Thank you.
Hello, thank you for having us, Representative Krieger and Representative Barker, members of the committee. I've been a fatal crash investigator for roughly 8 of my 12 years of being a police officer in Portland.
Can you give us your name, please?
Yes, sir. It's Dark, D-A-R-K-E. Last name's Hall, H-U-L-L. Sorry about that. During those 8 years, my main responsibility is to essentially interview and attempt to ascertain if there is impairment on the responsible drivers of the vehicle or vehicles that are involved in the crash. A lot of times when we attempt to contact these drivers, they are not able to talk. They are injured or they are medically sedated to the point that they cannot answer questions. Therefore, we cannot determine if there is any impairment. Fortunately, with alcohol, we were able to get that passed. But with controlled substances, there are crashes that are falling through the cracks. We find out about these crashes 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later, because there is no mandatory reporting that goes on. This would help out the major crashes and the minor crashes also. From the aspect that as soon as we get there, we'll be able to start working and determining who's at fault and what that impairment is. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this may be beyond the scope of what this particular set of witnesses is able to address, but from what I gather, the OSP Crime Lab doesn't currently do... I don't think they currently do controlled substance testing, and it's contracted out. So that's the first part. Okay, sounds like that's right. So, you know, I have to ask this.
This is going to probably change, and I think for the better. Overall policy, law enforcement, DA's approach to accident investigations, crash investigations, suspected controlled substance. And it's going to be more blood loss than crime lab. And so you have to inquire in this panel or maybe out there and address it. Is there going to be any kind of fiscal impact that we're looking at here that's really been thought of calculating? And how is this really going to affect your approach to the civil investigation?
Representative Hicks and co-chairs Parker and Krieger. First of all, thank you. That's a good point. That we don't know what we don't know. So we don't know the number of cases that are falling between the cracks. Most major crashes were called out on, and we actually are investigating. And there are cases where we do have other ways to find out. For example, if the person's crashed and we find a bong in the car, we have a pretty good sense that they might be intoxicated. We have enough for probable cause at that point, and we'll be writing a search warrant. What this does is it's a safety net that makes sure that we get the information so that people who are hurt by these drivers or killed by these drivers actually have some vindication in the law. I don't think the number is going to be a terribly big number, and I think in terms of the State Police Crime Lab, the testing is now being done, not at the crime lab, but there's another laboratory in Tualatin that came online. I know the crime lab is shooting for being online either this year or next year with their own controlled substance testing, but they've already assumed that. They've had that responsibility for years, obviously, for blood alcohol, so they have the forensic scientists on board. They have currently the capability and will test urine for us so that we can get some direction. If we have blood and urine, that tells us if it's in the urine, then it's more likely than not in the blood. Not definitely, but more likely than not still in the blood. And we then will test it at this laboratory. So a lot of the testing is happening now. We are going to catch some cases, and I think we're going to have better investigations because we're going to get in earlier, and there are some that will be cases we would have completely missed under the old regime of testing alcohol or notification for alcohol only. And I would note as an aside, not in particular response to yours, but I have that NHTSA study if as to people who are impaired, found to be impaired on drugs post-crash. So it gives you a sense of what the incidence is of this. So I believe November or October of 2010, it's a study that I think is very powerful. We can provide that.
I mean, just for the in generalities, what is your conclusion about the study? Do you be able to just tell us?
Well, I think as was currently summarized, approximately a third of the drivers out there who are in a crash, I don't want to get it wrong, I'd feel most comfortable reading it, but a fifth to a third. I know it's a fifth is the sort of the irreducible takeaway minimum, and I believe it's up to a third. I'd have to actually take the study and read it, reread the on the first page. But 18% is sort of the irreducible minimum of drivers who are in fatal crashes in 2009 were impaired with controlled substances. So that's obviously a very small group of fatal crashes, and those were the drivers who were killed. But it does, obviously, fatal crashes can turn, it can be fatal just as readily for a passenger or someone in another vehicle. So it's a very good benchmark for what's going on out there.
Representative Christman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is Mrs. Mars testifying? Gail Mars planning? Is she going to testify? Thank you. I'll wait then on my questions. Thank you.
Representative Nolan.
There may be others in the audience who can answer my question, which has to do with any effect that this might have on discouraging
patients from seeking care
if they are exposed to a non-dangerous level of a controlled substance. So do we have anyone from the health provider area testifying?
Okay. I believe Mr. Anderson from the Oregon College of Emergency Physicians is here and will be
signing. Okay, I'll
wait. Thanks.
Thank you. I understand the alcohol. Why didn't you add controlled substances 2 years ago? What was the conversation then? So if they're all full of dope and they're in a crash, I don't understand why we didn't do it then.
Representative Krieger, Co-Chair Barker, I believe that I recollect that it was a big enough job to amend the statute at the time, and we would have liked to, but it was small steps, I think.
Thank you.
And Representative Schaffler, I think just to maybe clarify a little bit, the law at that time already required the reporting of alcohol, so it was, I don't know when the statute was originally enacted, but it already required that reporting. It simply tightened up the timeline and allowed reporting to a police officer who was immediately present. I believe at the time, prior to that, it was 5 days that the healthcare facility had, and they could fax it to the sheriff, even if it was a Portland case. This law change in 07 said you are to report it to the police officer who's on site investigating.
Any further? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee.
Can you have Jim Anderson and Andy Easton come up, please?
Thank you, Chair Krieger, Chair Barker, Jim Anderson with the Oregon chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians. I will be brief and hopefully to the point. We do support 3085's House Bill 3085 in its intent and have supported issues like this repeatedly. We want to get impaired drivers off the road. A lot of people would think it's a make-work project for us, but that's not the point here. We want them off the road. We were asked to join in with a stakeholders group when this bill was introduced a couple of weeks ago, and gladly joined that group. And we had some concerns about the language in the bill, which we voiced our opinion throughout the stakeholders group meeting. First of all, in Section 1, we felt that it put an emergency physician in as a de facto member of law enforcement. One of the sacred oaths that we have is the patient-doctor relationship. We don't want anything coming between that. And to put a put law enforcement between what a doctor's duty is to their patient is, in our view, wrong. And so we had, during the stakeholder meeting, which Mr. Knott ran for us, apparently we were the squeakiest wheel at the meeting, because afterward we were asked to bring language forward that we thought would help the bill, which we did, and which I think that if this bill does come back for work session, we will see the amendments to the bill. Also, in lines 6 through 8 of Section 1 of the bill, you will notice that it says a person reasonably believed to be the operator of a motor vehicle. To our way of thinking, that requires a physician to come up with probable cause.
Something we don't believe should be the case, and so we didn't make that part of our statement for policy change or amendment change, but it's something that probably should be considered. Also, one last thing that we thought should be tested for, if you're going to test blood, you should
test urine. And we included that in the language we presented to Representative Barker's staff and to Mr. Knott. With that, I will close and turn it over to Ms. Easton.
Thank you, Chair Krieger and Chair Barker. Members of the committee, I'm Andy Easton, the Director of Advocacy for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. We are here also to support this bill and its concept. We have 58 hospitals, 32 of which are rural. And this bill, will, as written, does have some concerns for our rural hospitals. The blood testing for narcotic substance or controlled substance is very expensive. And most of those rural hospitals do not perform those tests. They use urinary diagnosis testing. So we would encourage that to be part of the bill. We were at this table 2 years ago when we did the alcohol testing bill, and we worked very hard to get that to be a good bill that would fit all of our needs, and we appreciate the work of the sponsor of the bill for bringing us to the table again. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, first I'll have a question of counsel, and then I have a question of the witnesses. I thought I understood that the intent of the bill was to require reporting of information that was collected anyway.
No.
But Ms. Easton's testimony suggests that she thinks that there would be an additional requirement imposed by the bill to perform tests that they're not currently performing. So which one is it?
Co-chairs, Representative Nolan, what I can tell you is how it's been construed up until this point, which is basically tests that the hospital or emergency care provider would be doing anyhow if they come up with a positive result. That creates an affirmative duty, but and nobody has said that I've talked to that they're obligated to do anything else. For this bill, I think the typical situation would be somebody's coming in, they're the victim of a traumatic crash, and they need to be screened to see if they have any narcotics on board, because if you give them painkillers, you might kill them. So they have to do those tests, but I think that's really the fact pattern this is aimed at.
Okay.
Thank you. If I might address the panel.
I think that addresses any concerns, or most of the concerns around fiscal impact. I think because if it's testing that they're already doing, then the additional cost would be notification, which may not be trivial, but if the number of cases isn't large, then it wouldn't be substantial. And I guess, Mr. Anderson, probably mostly to you, but perhaps Ms. Easton, you might weigh in. Do we have any concern about people who might hesitate to seek health services that they need if they are at risk of being outed?
Chair Krieger, Representative Nolan, yes, that has been expressed to me by several of our doctors when considering this bill, that if there is the stigma of being outed for drug use or alcohol use, primarily drug use, that they would opt to not come into the emergency department for treatment. That's always a concern, and it's not only with drugs. There's a lot of other things that other bills within this session have dealt with, child abuse, all kinds of things enter into that arena.
If I might just ask counsel one more question. Then,
as I read the bill, it addresses test results and doesn't address verbal communications. So if someone presents to an emergency room and does have a high blood alcohol content and tells the attending physician or a nurse that I also was smoking something or doing this, but it isn't tested, is that required communication?
And co-chairs, Representative Nolan, that is, there's no action contemplated within the statute. Any obligation to make that disclosure by my reading would have to be contained elsewhere in hospital procedure or something like that. There's no compulsion in the statute to that effect.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I think Representative Nolan raises a good concern, which is will a judge later on at some point decide that this confers some sort of obligation? So my question for committee counsel is, would it be possible to include a subsection 4 that states nothing contained herein shall compel a hospital or healthcare provider to perform a test that it would not otherwise perform in the ordinary course of their treatment?
Co-chairs, Representative Wan, that was actually vetted somewhat within the work group that we had previously. I could certainly raise the possibility of reintroducing that language back into a subsequent amendment, but my understanding, and I hope the individuals at the dais will correct me if I'm wrong, was that the feeling of the parties was that, keeping in mind, this language has been in effect for a while now, only as far as alcohol has been used, and as I said in the outset, so far it has not been construed to compel anything except that notification of a binary positive or negative. But if the parties aren't satisfied, we could certainly look into that.
Okay, Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Council, you used the term narcotics, and in the questions we've talked to, I think Mr. Anderson said drugs. The bill says controlled substance.
Co-chairs, Representative Wisner, I think I know where you're going with that. And again, this is probably a better question for them to answer, and please correct me if I make a misstatement. But again, the typical fact pattern here is going to be checking for controlled substances on board at the time that you come into the hospital that are relevant to what the hospital is doing. That means that if you have something in your system that might be cumulative with a course of treatment that they're going to give you, and of course a narcotic analgesic is the first thing that jumps to mind, but it doesn't need to be the only thing, where if they give you an anesthetic, it's going to cause potentially fatal cumulative medical complications. You know, you're basically going to be in a compelled overdose. So in order to figure out what treatment they're even going to be able to give you for medical, not law enforcement reasons, they have to run you through some screens. Now, these screens are not comprehensive because they're not going to test for something that isn't going to be, that might be a controlled substance, but isn't going to be interactive with the course of treatment that they're going to give you. So, and I'm extemporizing here, I doubt they'd be checking you for something like psychedelic mushrooms because they're not going to be reactive with the painkillers that they're going to give you. And again, lawyer, not a doctor, so I can't speak to the specifics. I can just say that it's not going to be a comprehensive inquiry. It's only going to look at things that are medically significant.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. And this is the chair and counsel again, too. In this committee, we always have a trouble trying to pass laws that says give someone reasonably believed or knowingly. So that's always something we need to concern ourselves as we pass this bill. I'm sure Mrs. Myers is going to discuss this. Thank you.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, to pick up right on that thread, and also I understand where Representative Juan is coming from in his line of questioning, and it is an excellent point that we need to be very careful in the crafting of this language, because I think there's a concern that the doctors can be made agents of the state, which would implicate a whole series of Fourth Amendment considerations that perhaps we're going to hear about later on from subsequent witnesses from the defense bar. So I do agree that my reading of it, I'm agreeing here with what counsel has been parsing as the language. I'm not seeing that this does implicate doctors as becoming now agents of the state, but it is something we need to be cognizant of as we're looking at the language of this bill. Thank you.
Okay. Anything else, committee? Thank you. Gail Myers and Andrea Myers.
Thank you, Co-Chairs Krieger and Co-Chair Barker, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Andrea Meyer, representing the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon, would join in my comments. She's in another committee on another bill. Otherwise, she wishes she could be here. My comments really are on two different levels of analysis, one basic framework of the bill itself, and then just a few comments with respect to its specific provisions. Representative Hicks, you mentioned it most recently. Are we asking doctors to become agents of the state? I do want to point out to the committee that the basic framework of the bill is that if the state cannot gather evidence on its own of wrongdoing, then it is now mandating people in a private confidential relationship with a person to make disclosures of certain facts to aid law enforcement to then go out and get a search warrant and then get its evidence. It's a legitimate and proper function of the police powers of the government to always, always, always try and gather evidence of wrongdoing. That's its job. And it's not its job to restrain itself. The restraint comes from outside the police powers. And so the restraint comes through the legislation enacted by this body and then by the Constitution as interpreted by the courts. But what this is an instance where the police powers are coming here and saying, we can't do our job easily, efficiently, all the time. So would you please compel someone who otherwise is in a confidential relationship to tip us off when we need to be on alert? That's basically the framework of the bill. We're concerned that it's a slippery slope. The toehold of yesterday with respect to alcohol becomes the stepping stone for today. And again, I think we'll see it again in some other instance. With respect to the provisions of the bill, I'll note that there is a difference now in the way in which the bill, and I haven't seen the amendments, and I don't know if the committee has. I know we've talked about some amendments, but I'm looking at the bill itself. As it relates to alcohol, the level of alcohol needs to be fairly high. So on line 11, it says the person's blood alcohol level meets or exceeds the percent specified in ORS 813.010, which is 0.08. Once you're at 0.08 or above, it's presumed you're impaired. So existing law requires the disclosure when the quantity of alcohol in the blood already exceeds legal limits. It's not mirrored in the same way as it relates to controlled substance. It says here on line 14 that it would compel the healthcare provider to make a disclosure when the person's blood contains a controlled substance. Not how much, not likely to be the cause of the accident, not likely to make them impaired, could be lawfully prescribed controlled substance. It's undefined. And so I do think, quite frankly, rather than putting this on parity with alcohol, which Mr. Sparks indicated was its purpose, I think, quite frankly, it broadens it and would require disclosure of any controlled substance, regardless of whether it's lawfully prescribed or not, regardless of quantity, regardless of whether or not the medical provider even reasonably suspects that it possibly could have been the cause of the accident. So I think this puts it far afield of where the alcohol provision is today. So we would oppose the bill on both principle as well as its specific provisions. I know that the ACLU also generally always has a concern about erosion of privacy rights, and those are implicated here as well.
Representative Shaw.
Thank you. I know these are very technical, legal, constitutional questions, and we're talking literally about seizing evidence from someone who involuntarily provides it about themselves. But it is a privilege to drive on the street, not a right. And how do we square away this with, because essentially we'd be making a mandatory report requirement on the doctor. But today we have mandatory reporting on a doctor for child abuse. So how do we say that's okay, and maybe you have a technical explanation that I could understand, that's okay, and maybe, but this isn't. I'm struggling with the difference here. Because if somebody's chock full of dope, we're not talking about somebody who walks in for a physical, gets a blood or urine test. We're talking about somebody who's crashed their car because they're all full of dope and maybe drunk, and they're violating their privileges and putting someone in danger, but it's okay not to compel them to voluntary information on that, evidence on that. But yet, somebody who comes in with a child that they've beaten up, but that's okay for us to require the doctor to mandatorily report that. I'm struggling with the difference here.
Thank you. Co-chairs and Representative Schaffler, two answers. I hope I get them right. And I had also thought of the mandatory child abuse reporting statute. The child abuse reporting statute is not limited simply to people with a private confidential relationship. It's expansive. So it could be a teacher who lives next door to a child. That teacher is a licensed professional. They have an obligation to report, even if it's outside the scope of their professional duties. It could be simply their neighbor, child, and that teacher would have to report if they reasonably suspected that neighbor child were the victim of some kind of abuse. There are exceptions in the child abuse reporting statute, recognizing that there are certain professional relationships, certain professional confidential relationships that are not obligated to be pierced through that reporting. So your comment is a good one, in that that does set up a paradigm, a framework of some people are obligated to report, not everyone, but some. And I would simply note that this, again, there is a confidential relationship between a physician and a patient, and in this instance, we're compelling the doctors to breach it.
Committee members, anything further? Representative Barker.
Thank you.
Chair. So somebody's involved in a crash. They're not just walking in, as Representative said. And they run a blood screen and they say, nope, no alcohol, no drugs. So we don't know what caused the accident. So would that not aid the defendant in showing their innocence?
Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger. If there is no, what this really does is creates a domino effect. So if there's nothing in the blood or urine, I understand there's going to be an exception for urine to an amendment, then there wouldn't report anything to law enforcement, and then there may not be a case. Mm-hmm. So I'm mindful, too, that law enforcement, once the facility says, we've done the urine test, we've done the blood test, there's a controlled substance in there, there is time for them to go get a warrant. I mean, they do that. They do now get search warrants for these things. But I think that absent the reporting, there wouldn't be a prosecution, and so then I don't think that there would be a need to establish innocence. This is an instance when there is something in the blood, and then it leads itself to a report, and then there's dominoes that flow from that.
Follow up.
But what I'm thinking of is where the evidence shows the person probably is not impaired, even though it would show a drug in there, or if they were had, you know, could say I have prescription drugs. I mean, that would all come into account. And again, this is people who have been involved in an accident. It isn't just somebody walking around the street and the police are saying, come here, give me your blood.
Co-Chair Barker and Co-Chair Kriegers, this is, again, getting back to the testimony of the proponents, they're not trying to do compelling any tests that otherwise would not have been done. So these are tests now that have been performed by the facility. They're not going to dissipate. So those reports would already be part of record in the medical file. And so I don't think it's an instance where the defense couldn't later access those reports and use them favorably to themselves. The issue here is simply, do you compel the physician, the facility, to make a disclosure that law enforcement otherwise would not hear about?
Can I make a statement? I do favor that. And I, in fact, burned one of my priority bills to bring this bill forward. And I would just like to say that in some sort of relevance to what we're talking about here, I've been out of the business for a while, you know, of doing this, but a little over a year ago, I was babysitting a young grandson. And my daughter got called out, is where we worked for Multnomah County, was called out in an accident, been out all day, been to the autopsy of the victim, and it was somebody had been run over, been beat up, and two cars ran over the person. And then I went with her because she was getting tired. I drove her down. We went to what's called seizure room where the police impound cars. And she and I and police officers and technicians went under the cars looking for the deceased body parts under that car. This isn't, I mean, when we talk about drunk driving, we kind of talk about the newspaper article, drunk driver crashes. This is serious stuff. People are dying, and it's vital that we do everything we can to make the people who are not drinking and their families safe. And I'll stop with that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anything further? Thank you.
Thank you.
It would appear, Mr. Co-Chair, we need an amendment.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
That's already in process.
Okay. Hey, we don't have anything. Anyone in the audience was going to testify that hasn't? Okay, that's fine. I'll close the public hearing on 3085 and close the committee for the day.